Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, and classic cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Swetman, and today we are kicking off season 4 of the podcast, which we are calling the Art House Starter Pack. This is designed to be an entry point into art house movies. If you are someone who has always wanted to know more about art house cinema, this is the place to start. In this episode, we are going to discuss a film from 1953 from Japanese director Yasujirō Ozu. The film is called Tokyo Story. The rest of season 4 has more great titles, including next from 1957, we will be looking at Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal, and then fast forwarding to 1979, the film Stalker from Russian director Andrei Tarkovsky. After that, we will look at 1985's Vagabond from French auteur Agnes Varda. Then we'll look at 1993's Blue from the Three Colors trilogy by Polish director Krzysztof Kieślowski. And finally, from 2011, we will discuss The Tree of Life from American director Terrence Malick. Over these 6 episodes, we will be joined by my good friend, Andrew Camarillo. He's a filmmaker, photographer, and cinephile, and he's the person in my life that I always think of when it comes to artsy movies. He has helped pick out these movies, some of which are new to me, and I can't wait to dig into them over the next several weeks. Just before we get into Tokyo Story, I thought we'd say hi to Andrew and find out what he's been watching lately. So, hello, Andrew. Thanks so much for joining the podcast for this season. How are you and what have you been watching lately?
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me. I've been watching quite a bit of TCM with my mom. Nice. And we've recently watched Casablanca and also The Magnificent Ambersons.
Oh, nice. I've never seen that.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. But yeah, I think the golden age of Hollywood cinema is mostly what we've been watching recently, which has been really fun and enjoyable for me.
Well, that's great. Yeah. So my previous guest on the last 6 episodes was Rance Collins, who has done a lot of work for TCM. And we, of course, talked about classic movies, including Casablanca. So this really is starting to sound like a TCM commercial, but TCM is great. So I'm happy with that. yeah, Casablanca is so good. And I'd seen it before, but then I rewatched it recently for this podcast episode a few weeks ago. And it's so good. It's such a powerful piece of history as well as cinema. Yeah,
that's definitely great. What have you been watching recently?
Yeah, I finally caught up with, it's from 2019, it's a more modern film. It's Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I had wanted to watch it because it was all the rage last year, it sounded like, and then finally hit Hulu a few weeks ago. And oh my gosh, it's so beautiful. Have you seen that movie yet?
I have not. I've actually wanted to see the film, but I haven't been able to yet. It sounds like you really enjoyed it.
Yes, absolutely recommend it. It's a love story, basically, a kind of forbidden love kind of a story. But it's one of the characters is a painter. And so she's always looking at the people she's painting. And a lot of it is, it's just shot as if it could be a painting. Every frame of it really is magnificently beautiful. And it's about art and it's about different perceptions of works of art. It's really amazing. It's I could feel like I could watch it 10 more times too. And hopefully I will revisit it pretty soon because it really is a great one. So I'll recommend that.
That's great. Yeah, I will definitely have to watch that.
Well, all right. Without further ado, then, let's go ahead and get into today's movie, Yasujirō Ozu's Tokyo Story. All right, let's talk about Tokyo Story. So this was my first time to watch this movie. Andrew, how many times have you seen Tokyo Story, roughly?
I would say maybe seven,
Wow.
eight times, something
Yeah.
like that. Well, also, I've watched it twice for this and almost three times. So almost
Oh,
four times just for the podcast, but probably 3 to 4 times, maybe four times, I think, before this. Yes.
that's great. So you'll be better prepared than me. So we were talking before this, but I almost do this podcast just as an excuse to watch another movie because I have young kids. I don't have a ton of time on my hands. So I thought, well, if I have to do a podcast about it, I'll definitely watch it. And this is one that I've always wanted to watch. Just as I knew it was a kind of a big name in the art house world. First of all, Ozu, but then also Tokyo Story. And, it's, and this podcast is also becoming, Andrew catches up on films that movie fans should watch because there's so many things. I'm like, well, I can't believe I've never seen that. And this is one of them. So I was really happy to finally watch it. I've just seen it the once, but I really thought it was a very beautiful movie. So I guess let's talk a little bit about Ozu. And so he's, again, he's a big name in cinema history. He's Japanese. And yeah, let's, I guess, talk a little bit about the movie. So Tokyo Story is. Would you say it's his most famous work or his most significant work?
Yes, I would. In Sight and Sound, the critics poll for Sight and Sound 2012 and the directors poll both had Tokyo Story in the top five films ever made. I think the directors poll had it first, and the critics poll had it third behind Citizen Kane and Vertigo.
Wow.
But yeah, I would say it's his most popular and well-known work. I think Late Spring is probably a close second, but Tokyo Story is probably the most well known.
Yeah, so that's the other title I'm most familiar with the name of is Late Spring. Have not seen it, but this is my first Ozu that I've actually watched. But I know he also has a series that it the title ends with sort of but ellipsis. So I know there's a I Was Born, but da da da.
Right.
And then a handful of others with that same kind of title construction. So I guess it's sort of about kind of growing up. And so what I've observed and what I've read a little bit, it seems like he's very interested in kind of generational conflict or divide or just kind of how and aging and different generations affect each other. And that definitely is a big part of this movie today. So is that something that he's always kind of done?
Yes, I think so. In his early period in 1927, he made his first film, and that film, I believe, was the only film that wasn't set in contemporary times. He made 54 films in his life, and I think 53 were contemporary, and they almost all of them dealt with generational conflict, generational change, the passage of time, and Japanese society going through the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and I guess, yeah, the early part of the 60s. His last film, An Autumn Afternoon, was made in 1962, and he actually died in 1963 on his birthday at the age of 60.
Wow, that's
So.
fascinating. Yeah, so I guess let's jump into Tokyo Story. So this one came out in 1953. So I guess it's kind of in the middle of, or maybe towards the end of his filmography. But he, so what this movie is about is basically, it opens with an older married couple, and they live in a small village or maybe a smaller city in Japan. And then they're planning a trip, so they're going to go to Tokyo to see their adult children. And they have four children, I believe. Is that right?
Yes, four
Yeah.
children, yes.
Three of whom live in the city, and then one lives back at home in the smaller city with them. That's the three live in Tokyo, and then one lives back at home, correct?
I think that two live in Tokyo, one lives in I believe Osaka or in
Oh.
another city. I think he's the train worker, or he works
Yes.
for the train company, and then the youngest lives at home.
Yes, that's right. So there's the one at home. Good deal. And so, yeah, that's right. One of their children we learned pretty early on also has passed on, has died in the war, the recent war, which was World War II, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So they take the train, and you see some of the, just challenges of older people traveling and that kind of thing. And then they get there and they You also, before they arrive, you see the grown children, one of their homes, and they have young kids of their own, and they're sort of stressed out a little bit as they're preparing for these guests to come. And basically then they're there, and we watch their interactions, and we see some really sweet moments between them. We see some awkwardness and some tension. And then as the story goes on, it just becomes more and more clear that these people are just in different places in their lives, and that really does lead to some conflict. They try to, I guess a few of the major plot points is that the mother and father, older mother and father, at one point, their kids say, you know, you can't stay with us tonight because we have guests or we have a work thing. Anyway, there's some awkwardness there, and they end up sending them to a hotel. And the hotel is loud, and they can't sleep, and so there's some generational tension there as well. And then yeah. I won't tell the very ending of the movie. I think we can hold that part back as a spoiler-free move, but it goes to a place that's really pretty emotional with all of it. So yeah, I guess that's kind of a major overview. I didn't get very specific there. Are there any other you think important plot points that should be brought up?
I think that the role of the daughter-in-law, you mentioned the son who had died in the war, yes. Her role in the film, I think, is very key in her relationship with her parent-in-laws. In traditional Japanese society, if a woman is widowed, she is still part of the family of her husband's family. So she in some way is connected with the family in a more intimate way than in, I would say, American society. Mm-hmm. And in the film, the parents do tell her that they would like for her to be remarried and they want her to be happy. Mm-hmm. But she seems in a way kind of in between worlds, kind of like on a bridge in some way between the past and the present and the future. She seems to be nostalgic or sentimental in some way, but also wanting to be kind of loyal to the family. And then also potentially looking forward to a life where she finds another love or just gets to kind of move forward in her life. Because I think at this time, her husband has been missing in action, I believe, for 8 years. So 8 years passed away. So I think her role is very important because of the care she provides and the genuine and authentic dynamic she has with the parents, where she's not even a blood relative. And then the actual children of the parents, at least the two oldest, I believe, are really seem sort of unconcerned with some of their preferences and don't seem to be very happy that they're there or enthusiastic about it. It seems more like an obligation or a chore for them to take care of them or to show them around.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And she ends up being my favorite scenes seem to be the ones with her because that dynamic is so interesting, specifically with her mother-in-law, which I guess we should mention some actors' names here. So who are the older parents? What are the actors' names for those?
Yes, Shishu Ryu is the dad. He's the father. Mm-hmm. He is in many of Ozu's films, in major roles and minor roles and choice roles and, you know, very marginal roles. His screen time's, you know, enormous or incredibly small. And in a way, he seems to stand in for Ozu in many of the films. And the German director Wim Wenders actually calls Shishu the kind of universal father of cinema. Mm-hmm. He seems to almost like the archetype of the father, according to Wim Wenders. And because we actually see him age, and he plays the role of a father or grandfather early in his career. And he is actually only a few months younger than Ozu. So I think he was born in 1904. Mm-hmm. And he is working in as an actor in his 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. And he actually goes on to work, I think, into almost his 80s after Ozu has passed away. But in many films, he is the father or the grandfather. And we see the transitions of him as a young father and then growing older and older and having generations after him. And we actually get to see a person age and age in their role over almost a lifetime, which is really amazing. And of course, not playing himself, but playing different characters.
That's really amazing. Of all the actors in this, he was the one that felt familiar. I haven't looked through to see where I might have seen him before, but he felt like I'd seen him in something else. I think his performance is really moving in this. And who plays the mother?
The mother is Chikayawe Higashiyama. She is, I think, excellent in the film as well. And I'm very moved by her performance, particularly her interactions with her husband, played by Ryu, and then the daughter-in-law, who is played by Setsuko Hara, which was considered, I think, the Greta Garbo, I believe, of Japanese cinema. So she's, I believe, she's considered one of the most iconic Japanese film actresses from that time period.
Wow. Yeah, she's fantastic as well. Let's talk about some of our favorite kind of moments or themes that we picked up on. The major theme is that generational, it's conflict at times, but just the divide, like the disconnect that felt really familiar in some ways. And, when you're dealing with your parents who are a couple of generations older than you, there's just some natural disconnect there. And this movie really captured that in a way that I thought was really powerful. There's a line. So first of all, I thought it was great that it's not just these older parents with their grown children, but we also see some tension between the children and their own children, so the grandkids, which are young kids, and they are a little bit willful and mouth off a little bit, and then the grandparents are just saying, "Oh, kids are kids," and so there's that kind of feeling in the movie as well. And then actually one of the, I think my favorite scene in the whole thing is the scene between the grandmother and the grandchild, and they're out on a hill, and there's a really beautiful shot of them up on this grassy hill, and she's just kind of talking at him, kind of speaking very poetically, and he's just playing, and she says, "I wonder if you'll become a doctor like your father." And he says, "By the time you become a doctor, I wonder if I'll still be here." And so she just has that big overview of her life that, he's going to have his own life and she may not see much of it as she gets older. And, I just found that really, really beautiful and moving. That's a great scene. I wrote in my notes here too, just the burden of aging parents. And so that's to a certain degree, they're responsible for taking care of their parents. And so you feel that tension too, as they kind of bicker between themselves. And, it does feel like, as you mentioned, almost, an obligation more than something they're excited to do because they have their lives. And they even talk about that. The parents talk about, these kids, they have jobs, they have lives, they have things they have to do. And, it's really great. I have another favorite line I was looking for. There's a great scene where, the father is, he ends up at a bar and he's drinking with some old friends who he hasn't seen in a really long time. And there's these three older guys and they're talking about, and they get very drunk, and they're talking about their children and how, I really got a sense of how much the way their children turned out affects them. And how, one of them says that he lies to people about his son's job because he wishes his son had a more prestigious job. And they say, "Oh, you wish, you're lucky your kids are better than mine," and all this. And that's, I've never been that age and I've never had, grown kids or grandkids. And so it was, eye-opening for me that, that may be something that our older generations feel pretty commonly, is that kind of feeling about your own kids and how they, turned out. Another line in that, I think in that scene, is talking about, I can't remember what exactly the context is, but he says, "A married daughter is like a stranger." And so he's just commenting on his daughter's gone and getting married, and now she has her own family, and she is just not the person that he remembers when they were growing up. I thought that was a really potent and emotional line too. So yeah, those are some of my favorite moments there too. What about you?
Yes, I wanted to say, Shushu Ryu, during the scene you were speaking of when his friend is speaking to him about the disappointment in a way of mm-hmm. his child not having a more prestigious job. Shushu kind of says, well, should we expect that much of our children? He mm-hmm. acknowledges that he does feel at times a bit disappointed that his son, who is a doctor, is just a neighborhood doctor. But then he says, Tokyo is crowded and maybe, you know, our expectations are too high, you know, for our kids. Mm-hmm. There's this kind of ambivalence in Ryu, which is very evident, that there is this want for more, but then also this realization and acknowledgement that maybe he shouldn't, and also it's not his role to do that. Yeah. It's his son's life in a way. And there is that, the feeling of ambivalence between wanting more and expecting something of your children, but also realizing they are themselves and their own being, and you have to let it go. And there's kind of this acceptance that I think happens in a lot of Ozu, and I think we may speak about it later, but in the film, there's this sadness, but there's this acceptance of life mm-hmm. and doing what one can with the environment or the situation that one finds oneself in. I think it's very powerful, this sort of resolute sadness, but this mm-hmm. It's this strength in this acknowledgement as well, I think.
Yeah, it kind of captures the beauty and the tragedy that's just always going to be there for family relationships. And and both so strongly. It's really beautiful that those coexist.
I was going to say that also in watching this film, I watched it with my girlfriend, Vanessa Marie, which mm-hmm. is she and I watched this film, and she provided, I think, some really good insights for me. And what I mentioned earlier about the daughter-in-law being sort of the bridge mm-hmm. Kind of between the idea of the past, which is maybe can be represented by the parents, the older couple, mm-hmm. and then her brother and sister-in-law, who are kind of in Tokyo working very hard, career oriented, mm-hmm. and looking towards sort of the future and kind of involved in like this productivity and efficiency, this way of life that kind of loses some of the past. Mm-hmm. She's sort of working in herself in this sort of feeling of wanting to move forward, but also wanting to hold on to something of the past. There's this nostalgia in some way. So I think that's really interesting. Her character, I'm drawn to her character as well, in the sense of she seems to be the one trying to work through mm-hmm. the dichotomy, the difficulties of the modern world, while also retaining some mm-hmm. some connections to the past and memory, and her dead husband and this older couple that are her parent-in-laws, so her in-laws. I think that's really amazing. And the favorite scene for Vanessa, and she pointed this out, and I really liked this scene, and when I re-examined it, and I was like, yeah, this was amazing. When the couple is in Atami for the hot springs. It's when their children send them off to kind of get away from mm-hmm. Tokyo, to kind of get out mm-hmm. of their hair, to be away. When they're on near the beach and mm-hmm. they are mm-hmm. on the walkway, and there's this recognition between the two. They had just been kept up all night by rowdy occupants in the hotel singing and playing. And that's sort of an area where younger people would go. And you see younger people playing games. And they're just kept up all night. But they kind of have this back and forth the next day when they're out on the beach, on the walkway near the beach. And they're saying, oh, I didn't sleep a wink, I think the mother says, and the father responds, you did, and you snored as well. Yeah. And then she laughs. She's like, oh, did I? And there's this intimacy that exists without them having any physical contact almost throughout the whole film. There's very little physical contact between most of the characters. But there's the beauty of it. And she also has a moment where she gets a bit dizzy, and they're about to leave, and she's trying to get up, and she becomes dizzy. The her husband turns to her and seems to be, you know, concerned and asks kind of what's going on. And then she's able to eventually get up and they walk away together down the walkway near the beach, kind of in file behind she behind him.
Yeah.
And it's just a beautiful image of kind of like intimacy and connection that is also well shot and very simple and very minimal in many ways, but not. It still has like a power to it. I think that evokes a lot of motion and this closeness that we don't always, we're not always privy to. And I enjoy that about Ozu. There are things that are withheld and he doesn't always show the moments that are, I think in Western cinema, key moments that you want to show, like something happens that's a very dramatic event. He'll often kind of move past that or not have the characters express something that could be, we kind of find out secondhand indirectly about certain things that happen. And I think that's a really interesting way to make film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that gets at, so a word you just mentioned is minimalism. And I think that that's something that I was really struck by too. So they're in Tokyo, but there's almost no shots of the city or like establishing shots. Like I would expect, you know, a city of this shot of the skyline or something like that. Not that I don't know what the skyline looked like in the 50s at that point. But it's almost all the camera's always kept in these tight quarters and in the home. It's a very domestic story. The camera almost never moves. It's pretty much stationary, I think, almost the whole time. And so it's like you understand the context that they're in this big city, and that has a huge effect on the story and on the lives of the grown children. But we stay in these intimate moments. It's almost all indoors as well. There's that shot or that scene out on the beach like you're talking about. And then there's the scene on the hill that I mentioned earlier. Other than that, I think almost all of this takes place just inside homes. So I think that's minimal style does a lot for the movie. And I think, I'm sure that's something that is going to come up in a minute because we're going to talk a little bit more about his style. And maybe this is a good transition into getting into that. So tell me about, I guess, let's jump into Ozu and kind of what he's known for, people he's influenced, and the style of his filmmaking.
Yeah, I think that Ozu has had a really large impact on filmmakers around the world throughout the last three or four decades. His style was described by Paul Schrader, who wrote a book about the transcendental style, as sort of transcendent. Schrader meant by that sort of maximizing the mystery of existence, I believe is how he described it. A transcendental filmmaker will use often what are these kind of devices to show characters and development of plot and story in a way that are almost kind of dramatic devices that are used. And the transcendental artist or filmmaker will sort of drain them in a way out of their, it's about everydayness. And I think the best way to describe it is to present life as it is in the kind of quotidian of the repetitive way of being. And if you notice how the characters greet each other, it seems to be like, hello, it's a beautiful day today. Oh, it will be hot today. Yeah. Oh, commenting on the weather. Very
mundane.
What could be considered mundane communication. But in this, we see a real life, and that for many people at this time, particularly in Japan, and even today in America, there is a lot of small talk. There are these routines and repetitions most people have in life. But in that, we can find what is what life is about. And I think that's really important to show that there doesn't need to be a ton of dramatic effect or pushing you towards an emotion or pushing you towards a thought that's incredibly contrived and just overbearing. And I think Ozu's been said to like showing instead of telling.
Yeah.
So there's this, he kind of just shows a scene and allows the characters, as you said, many of the shots are interior shots and they are rectangular usually, or even square. And Ozu is well known for using, I think, a 50 millimeter lens called a tatami shot, with a Japanese traditional floor mat. So it's maybe a few feet or even less off the ground, and it allows the audience to see the characters stand up, sit down, mm-hmm. and move side to side, seeing their whole body usually, and the depth of field. The traditional Japanese home, you're able to see characters in the foreground, in the midground, and in the background, all aligned in certain ways. Mm. And the movements within those spaces are really interesting. Also, Ozu does not really care for keeping the camera in a way that seems like logical for, I think, for contemporary Western cinema. Mm. You'll see a shot of a character from one angle, and then the camera will be completely on the opposite side of the body, and the character has now moved to the opposite side of the screen. Mm. He kind of uses 360 degree spacing for camera movement, rather than the 180 that many filmmakers use. So you see a shot of a character talking, then it cuts to another character talking in a way where the camera is just moving. He's just picking up the camera and moving it in other locations while filming. So I think that's an interesting perspective. And the style is minimal, and it is focused on the everyday and within the limits. I think that's where Ozu does some of his best work. And his actors, he would have them retake scenes 20, 30, 40, some 60 times. Mm. And the scenes sometimes would require no dialogue. They would just be sewing something and then gulping or swallowing very hard and then looking a certain way.
Wow.
And one of the actresses that had worked with him said that she did this, and eventually he said, okay, that's good. And she realized, she was getting frustrated, but eventually she realized he wanted her to take her mind off of the focus on doing the sewing and just act in a way that was almost like she was embodying what she was supposed to be doing in the film, and kind of lose sight of, okay, I'm acting in this, I'm doing this thing. It's like, okay, it's become almost like automatic. Mm. And I think that's the way Ozu sort of directed. He was very meticulous about the decor, the interior, the design. He would actually look through the camera, which for a lot of cinematographers, directors of photography as well, like, that's a no-no. They don't want the director just like all of a sudden jumping and looking into a camera. He would do that often, and he would control almost every facet of the films. And he wanted the focus to be very specific and very controlled. And I think he did a really great job at sort of focusing our attention on small details and not on the waiting for this massive thing to happen, or that, you know, dragging us to this plot point. It's sort of unfolding in time that is allowed to breathe. And I think that's really a beautiful thing.
I like that. And my only observation would be that I think that I just became aware of who Paul Schrader was a few years ago with First Reformed, the movie he directed, and then kind of heard some interviews with him and learned that he was very interested in and had been a scholar on this transcendental style and written this book about it. And that's actually how I first learned of Ozu and was like, wow, I need to dig into some of that. But I remember something he said in an interview once, because he'd made several movies, but he hadn't quite employed the transcendental style himself until First Reformed. And so he was talking about doing that. And he said that one of the things he wanted to employ was boredom, actually. Like, how can you show this mundane life? And in doing so, whenever something a little bit bigger does happen, it stands out a little more, or it hits a little bit more emotionally, because you've been drawn into this. So there is something at the end of Tokyo Story that is a little bit of a bigger plot point that we're not going to spoil, but it became much more emotional, I think, because we'd seen these people in just their mundane everyday lives. And if you see in First Reformed, I think that's a similar thing. You see Ethan Hawke's character doing his basically boring day job that he doesn't even like that much. And then there's a few really big things that happen, and they stand out because of that, that kind of contrast. Yeah. That's
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're right. Like, the resonance of anything that happens, mm-hmm. That could happen in many movies, like a divorce or, you know, an overdose or a death or a marriage, something like that will hit much harder in Ozu films because it's showing life. And as in all our lives, we are, most of us are not undergoing dramatic events daily. So, and large events daily. So when they do happen, they are very precious to us and they are very meaningful to us. But in film, because we're watching something that's, you know, usually around 2 hours or so, they're trying to take us on this journey. So many films have these things start off a little slow and then they ramp up very quickly. But everyday life is not present in many films. But you're right. The sense of boredom is important. The sense of the routine, the repetitive is really, really important. But to like to show it and to value it is really amazing because it can become to a point, if not done well, where the audience loses focus and is completely uninterested in what's going on. Right. But I think Ozu requires the attention of the audience, but not to a level where we are sitting for 40 minutes just watching like an Andy Warhol film and nothing's happening, someone's sleeping or something. So I think that's really important. Things are happening. There are details that are important that are being shown, but doing it in an unpushy or unfussy way. I think that's really good.
I think that's a good way to put that. And yeah, and so doing such a minimal thing like that, it also, I think, serves to make it feel more universal. So, I watched, I watched this movie on the Criterion Channel, which, if you're into these kind of movies and you're not subscribing, I recommend it. It's really great. They have a ton of art house movies there, including a lot of Ozu films. And they had a special feature with a Jamaican director. And he was just talking about why he loves this movie. And he said he watched it when he was young and he was like, well, how is this movie from, you know, 60 years ago from an old Japanese man perfectly capturing my relationship with my grandmother? And I think that kind of gets at the universality of, the feelings and the relationships here, that it really does. It can feel so familiar, even though it's in a really different context, which I've kind of mentioned on the podcast before. One of my favorite things about watching movies from a different culture or from a different time period is that you feel those commonalities and you suddenly feel more connected to the rest of humanity. It really can be a really spiritual thing. And maybe that's part of what's meant by transcendental, when we're talking about movies like this, is that it tells a really small story seemingly, but it transcends that and can be a much bigger thing. It also reminds me, so previously, Andrew, you were on the podcast to discuss the movie, Synecdoche, New York, which is a very different movie. But one of the things I think we kind of discussed there was, movies like that can, the way it made me feel was like, I feel like I'm really small and I'm just a part of a really big universe, but I'm also important. It makes me feel small and big at the same time. Like the experience of one person can be a really important thing. And that movie did that well. I think this movie kind of indirectly does that. And looking ahead to the other movies we're going to discuss, I know that at least one that I've seen has very strongly gives me that same feeling. And we'll kind of get to that when we get there. But I'll be interested to watch as we go through these other movies if we have a similar sort of transcendent feeling with some of them. But I think this movie's really great, and it does that, and it kind of hits that universal place that it's something that's really great to dig into. So I'm so glad we're discussing it here. So we've mentioned that Ozu has been very influential. Do you know some big names of people that he's influenced in kind of more modern times?
Yes, Ozu has had influence on contemporary directors like Paul Dano, actors Michael Cera, Lindsay Anderson, of course, Paul Schrader. And I believe that Wim Wenders made a documentary, Tokyo Go, about Ozu. And it's really an amazing documentary as well. But Ozu's reach seems to be European cinema, American cinema, Asian cinema, and has just had a wide impact on films. And I think that it's really telling that his simple style was able to still influence filmmakers who use, you know, a vast variety of styles, but they still have this sense of what he meant to cinema and the effects that he had on how to tell a story. Paul Dano recently said that when he watched Ozu, he was surprised that you can make films in this way. You could make films about everyday life and kind of limit the amount of, I guess, massive happenings and just focus on the repetition of daily life and the kind of small aspects and preciousness of life. And I think that's really amazing. And I'm glad his work is continuing to have influence over the decades. And we're seeing that still.
That's a great quote from Dano. That's definitely a sense that, that I got from this. And it's, yeah, it's great to hear that that's been so influential going forward. What else? Do you have any other thoughts about kind of the style or Ozu himself or anything else you want to mention?
I think there's Mano no Awara. It's like a, what he deploys at times, this sympathetic sadness, this resigned sadness, kind of what I mentioned earlier. There's this kind of a knowing and calm serenity about the uncertainty of life that is present. Vanessa actually commented that it's the emotions are so private and contained, but there's this vividness beneath them. The characters do a great job that through their gesturing, through their movements, and Shushu Ryu, the father, often says the same kind of to us, to me, it sounds like something like this. This is slight variations of this sound that signifying many things, it seems. This recognition, this questioning, this just a slight sort of tone that he's using when he makes a sound, and I don't believe it's a word, carries such significance. And a look from a sibling to a sibling really says a lot. So there's not a need. I mean, in the film, there are several sequences for longer dialogue, but often in the film, the dialogue is kept, as we've said, light, sort of small talk, or very minimal. And I, but when things are expressed, they're often nonverbal. And when something is said, there is importance to it. When it's something that's not just small talk, when it's expressing, at times, as we've kind of talked about between the husband and the wife, the older couple, there's this understanding and this, the smiling that happens or the questioning that kind of happens with just their gestures or their annoyance or their frustrations, by setting up or moving in a certain way. It's really, I think, impactful. I did want to say that, I think Ozu is, he's known as the most Japanese of, Japanese directors. But I think because of his style and their, in Paul Schrader's book, The Transcendental Style, he does speak about the one corner painting. Japanese painter, I think several centuries ago, would create paintings in which he would only paint a corner of a canvas and the rest of the canvas would be blank. But in that one, the blank canvas was actually a major part of the work. And Ozu, I believe, is working with silences and what is called codas. So these still lives and these moments when we're, when you said earlier about going to Tokyo, we didn't see a lot of, okay, the skyline or we're in Tokyo, but he did show like, I think an industrial plant.
Yeah, I noted that. Yeah. You see this industrialization a few times. Go ahead. Yeah.
Right. And I, and also these linen, you see these like shirts at different times or this still shot of hallways. That's, I think, very powerful. That sort of allows these pauses. It's a pause, but it's also like a emphasis on time passing and the context and the environment in which we're in now. And I think it allows us to kind of absorb what is happening and also to give a bit of reflection to where we're at in the film, but also space to think. And I really enjoy those moments. And I think they're just as important as the dialogue at times that's going on or the plot points that may be appearing at times. I think those pauses are very essential. And as well, I think he uses temporal ellipses, where he's sort of like, we're going from one point to another and we're not seeing anything that's like mm-hmm. the journey by train. We're just seeing you're here, we see a still shot, these codas, and then we're now moving to interiors in a different city. These things are really interesting to me, and I think they can be powerful because it allows us to think, you know, what has happened, what's going on, and also to pay attention that we're there present with what is happening. So yeah, I really enjoy the style. I enjoy the consistent cinematography, the square, the rectangular shots. Mm-hmm. I think he uses a tracking shot maybe twice in the film. I think both of them come when the older couple have been kicked out sort of by their daughter's mm-hmm. hair salon, and you see them kind of preparing to figure out where they go next. And it reminds me of this film is sort of based off in some ways a Leo McCary film from 1937, Make Way for Tomorrow, an American film.
Interesting.
That is a really beautiful like post depression film. The economic depression in the United States is a very moving and well-made film. And the older couple has this moment where they're kind of walking side by side, not sure what will happen next, not sure, mm-hmm. you know, the next steps of their lives. And it's very precious and very powerful, I think. But Ozu does use those tracking shots very rarely. But I think for good purpose, but I do like the consistency in which he shoots and allowing us to just be almost like a stage. It seems like each shot for me mm-hmm. is sort of a stage that we're entering, and we see whatever he's allowing to happen within mm-hmm. within that frame. And then we move to something else. But, yeah, it's very meditative, I feel.
Yeah.
Film.
Yeah, I agree. And I just want to say that when those camera tracking shots do finally happen, as you mentioned, it's when they've just been more or less kicked out. They even say at one point, I guess we're really homeless now or something like that.
Yeah,
and right. you the camera suddenly moving, you suddenly feel this untethered, like they don't know what's going to happen, like they are a little bit lost in that moment. Speaking of what you just mentioned about sort of the pauses that it would take to show that industrialized city, because it doesn't show a ton of shots of the city like I would expect, as I mentioned, but it does show that, which I think gives the sense that this is like the new culture, the new they say a couple times something about the life moves really fast in the city or something like that, it's too fast for us old people, so something along those lines. I had the word popped into my head that it's kind of poetic cinema. And someone, actually my sister-in-law, like last year, I think, asked me about movies that I would consider poetic. And it really made me stop and think about what does that maybe mean? And I thought about like the way you read a novel versus the way you read a poem. And is that, I think, pauses is a big part of that. When you're reading a poem, you're going to stop and consider, how does that connect? What does that mean? More than you would with a novel or a narrative story. So I think this can be considered poetic cinema for that reason, that it allows you those pauses, as you mentioned, to stop and consider that. So I think that's an interesting thing. But yeah, what other things do you have to say about Tokyo Story?
Vanessa and I spoke about the scene between the mother and then the daughter-in-law when the parents are sort of kicked out of the hair salon of their mm-hmm. daughter, and they mm-hmm. go in separate directions. The mother goes to the daughter-in-law's home, mm-hmm. and she is not very economically, you know, she's not doing great financially.
Very small apartment.
Right. And she's, I think, sharing a kitchen sink and probably a bathroom. Mm-hmm. The communication they have, I think, is very intimate and beautiful and honest. And it seems to me that the daughter-in-law really wants to care for and show affection for her mother-in-law. And the mother-in-law thinks that's amazing. It's very nice. But she also wants her to live her life and is encouraging her to, please, it would make me happy if you wanted to get married or, you know, move on in your life and do something that may not be part of this family, our family, that's mm-hmm. fine. My son has been dead for 8 years or missing in action, mm-hmm. probably dead. So, and there's this recognition of her, this sense of wanting to hold on to this, the daughter-in-law, this past, where she may even feel that, I think earlier in the film, the father and the mother speak to her about their son and said, you know, our son was kind of, you know, a bit, you know, he, you know, things could have been difficult for you, it seems like. Mm. And she kind of acknowledged that. But then she said, I miss those difficult times. Mm. So there's this nostalgia for being in a relationship with him. But she also seems to be hoping for the future. And one of my favorite scenes, two of my favorite scenes happened at, near the end of the film, when there are conversations between her and the husband, and sort of the expression of gratitude he gives for the care she mm-hmm. has provided for mm-hmm. he and his wife.
Yeah.
And I think that's really amazing. And actually, he gives her a watch, which was a family kind of a watch, a family heirloom in a way, I suppose.
Yeah.
Maybe not heirloom, but a family object that meant a lot to he and his wife. And it's given to her, and it signifies in some way to me that you please live your life and be happy. He even tells her that, I want you to be happy, but you will always have you know, us with you in some way. And we may never even see you again, because where they live is so far from Tokyo and she's working. So they may never see each other again. And it's this thing that she holds on to, that I think is a very beautiful, token in a way. And, have you seen The Hours, the film, The Hours?
I've not seen it.
Okay. Vanessa showed it to me, and in the end of the film, Virginia says, "The hours, always the years, always the hours." So it's this sense that the time that they shared and that they had was so precious. And I think that's shown throughout the film, these generational conflicts that occur, these differences in like living situation, you know, modern Japan at the time, Tokyo, I mean, and then a rural community or a small town. There are big differences in lifestyle, in economics, in culture. But to value the time and to connect with the time that you have with your loved ones and those who really mean something to you is, I think, very powerful. And that kind of relates to the second, the other conversation I mentioned, where she then talks to the youngest daughter of the family, her sister-in-law. And the sister-in-law is really upset by how her siblings have treated her parents and kind of been rude in ways, and also just like neglectful of them and not really respectful. And she's upset. She's very upset. And she's like, I never want to become that way. And, you know, they were very selfish. And the daughter-in-law, played by Setsuko Hara, she says that, well, you know, you're maybe when you get the age of your sister, you may realize there's a lot going on. You have your own life and people change over time. There are these things that happen to you and you change. And then the younger sister says, well, you're not. You're here and you're doing, you know, being considerate. And she's like, will you change? And she's like, yeah, maybe despite my best effort, I may change and I am maybe changing. And we notice that in some ways she may be changing in the sense of like maybe moving forward in her life, something else. And I think that's very powerful because she recognizes she doesn't want to pass judgment. And yes, she realizes in some way that like the younger sister is correct. Some of the other siblings are acting a bit selfish at times and rude and not considerate, but they also have their own experiences and their own how they were raised, because actually the father used to drink previously. And so the older sister references that quite often. I think it made it very difficult. I think you referenced the drinking. They eventually, the father and his buddy end up at her salon drunk and unexpectedly in the middle of the night. And she has to deal with that. And it's said also that the father has stopped drinking now that the youngest daughter had been born. So for like, you know, 15, 18 years or something, he hasn't been drinking. So her relationship with her father is different than her sister's. And there's this, I really like how the daughter-in-law is engaging and kind of saying that, you know, we can all change and we have to be aware of that and not pass judgment. But there is this sense that she wants to retain this connection and this care, even though life will be going on and her life will change. I really like those conversations she has with the father and the youngest sister. So yeah, I really like Ozu, and I really think that the minimalism and just the controlled formalism of the work allows these beautiful structures or these beautiful experiences to happen within these maybe to some rigid structures, these sort of very controlled environments. Mm-hmm. I think beautiful acting can occur and beautiful compositions when done really well. It's sort of like, I guess, like writing poetry informally, like mm-hmm. a sonnet or a haiku within, like, if you're really good at it, if you have these rigid structures, you can make wonderful things within those structures, mm-hmm. and it kind of aids in the creative mm-hmm. experience. And I really like that.
Yeah, having those limits can help you to innovate, and that's proven really true in any creative work I've done before. So I think that's a good point. I wanted to mention one last thing as we kind of wrap up, and that's in that same conversation between the younger daughter and the daughter-in-law, like I think directly after the lines you referenced, the younger daughter says, isn't life disappointing? And the daughter-in-law, just with this kind of wry smile on her face, so yes, it is, but she's still smiling. And I think that was at the sort of the crux of, you know, this, there's sadness, there's beauty, all of that tied together in that moment. I was like, that's really something. And then the performance of that line is really great as well. So yeah, I love that. And I really loved finally watching this movie. Any final thoughts before we kind of wrap this up?
No, I guess only that it was a pleasure to go back and watch this film. Mm-hmm. I watched it two full times now, and then like almost the third, I almost watched it again. I watched a considerable part of it, mm-hmm. but before this, the last time I had watched it had been several years, mm-hmm. and many years, I think, but it's very beautiful and touching, and it kind of, sort of my relationship with my grandmother on my mother's side, what reminded me a lot of mm-hmm. the mother in the film, and mm-hmm. it's very, very moving to see sort of the relationship that the daughter-in-law has with her, and I feel connected to that in some way, not like me as the daughter-in-law, but just that character mm-hmm. of the mother is really powerful for me. And to see care taken in the film with such nuance is very beautiful. And I think, like you said, the line of life is disappointing, she smiles and says, yes, it is. But then she goes on to say, please visit me mm-hmm. in Tokyo if you're there. And we can believe her. She's incredibly genuine. Mm-hmm. She wants her to visit, and she will like host her if she visits. It's like this balance between this acceptance of the inevitable change that happens in life, sometimes good, sometimes bad for the mm-hmm. individual, with the choice to act in ways that like show care and show connection. Mm-hmm. I think that's an amazing feature of his films. And, lastly, I believe a filmmaker had said that kindness first, then justice are a large part of Ozu films. Mm. Kindness first, then justice. And I really think that's really powerful. So, wow.
Yeah, that's really great. You definitely see that embodied in the daughter-in-law and her, even in the face of Shuck, she fully understands the social slights that are happening and the ways that these parents are being mistreated or not treated well enough. But she is the most gracious person and the kindest to everyone around her. And I think that's really great. That's wonderful. Well, I think we can call it an episode. Thank you so much for joining me, Andrew, for this one. I can't wait for next time, which we're going to talk about The Seventh Seal, which I've seen once before and really connected with it. I can't wait to see it again and kind of jot down my favorite lines. It's a dialogue-heavy movie, but also has a lot of, I think, symbolism and some kind of iconic things in it as well. So we will get into that next time. But thanks so much for joining us. And we'll talk to you then. We appreciate you being here.
All right. Thank you, Andrew.
And that will do it for this episode. If you want to support Art House Garage, you can leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or whatever podcast app you're using. And you can keep up with Art House Garage on social media. We are at Art House Garage on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Letterboxd. You can also find video reviews and on YouTube, as well as reviews and events, event coverage over at the blog at arthousegarage.com. You can also email me if you have any thoughts or feedback, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.